Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
Jad?
Hey.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good.
I'm Jad Abumrad. This is Radiolab with dispatches 6 through 10. Pat Walters, senior editor, is going to start us off. Okay.
Okay. So you and Molly had this idea to do an episode about the 1918 flu.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I get into something historical, I go to the newspaper archives.
Okay.
I think they're so cool. You know, coronavirus is in the news everywhere. We've been talking about this on the show. And I thought, like, oh, what did this look like in 1918? But yeah, so I decided to just like go to the New York Times archive, start in October, which was the peak of the second wave of the 1918 flu.
Gotcha.
So sort of like people are talking about how things are opening up again, and like we might have a second spike of the coronavirus, and like what people are afraid of is that what happened in 1918 will happen now, which is it was pretty bad when it emerged in the winter of 1918 in the beginning of the year, and then it kind of went away, and then everyone was like, oh, it's gone, and went back to normal, and that fall it spiked, and like most of the people who died in that flu died in this second fall.
I actually honestly didn't know that that's the trajectory it took. It kind of freaks me out, to be honest. Anyhow, okay, sorry.
So you go to the New York Times in the fall of 1918, and I remember struggling to find the flu. It's all World War One. The front page of the paper on October 1st, 1918 has huge, like, 20-point font headline across the whole page. Bulgaria quits the war. Turkey may follow. War's fiercest fighting on Cambrai front. I don't know what these things mean. I don't understand World War One enough to know what any of this means, but it's just like all war. French advance on every front. Every day. British take many towns.
All fall.
Turkey also seeks peace. Austria seeks to quit war. Page 2, page 3. USS Tampa. There's little maps, there's profiles of officers and different units, what they were doing in the war, where they were killed. 692 casualties. You have entire articles, which are just names of all the people killed. And you keep going, page 5, 6, 7, pretty much all war stories. You know, as you get into the low teens, you get the flu stories. Just little briefs saying like, St. Louis closed its businesses, or the health commissioner has decided not to close the schools, even though everyone's saying you should close the schools.
Mm.
Or like, the flu is in China now. And that's the whole story. It's just like...
Really?
Flu in China is the story.
Just that sentence?
That's it.
Oh.
So this is how the coverage goes all fall. War stories, war stories, war stories. And so my favorite example of this situation is December 20th, 1918. It's another day, another typical day at the New York Times with no flu coverage on the front page. Pretty much no flu coverage until the last page. And there, wedged in between a very fussy, long story about like who owns some cable lines. It's like a half a page long story. I don't even understand what it was about. And an ad for shirt collars, you know, which were a thing then, is this tiny five-sentence story with this headline: 6 million died of influenza.
Oh, off.
And the subhead is regarded as world's greatest plague since the Black Death. So this five sentence story stuck in the last page of the paper says this: the Times' medical correspondent says that it seems reasonable to believe that throughout the world, about 6 million persons have died from influenza and pneumonia during the last 3 months.
Oh my God.
It has been estimated that the war caused the death of 20 million people in 4.5 years. Thus, the correspondent points out, influenza has proved itself 5 times deadlier than war, because in the same period, at its epidemic rate, influenza would have killed 100 million. Never since the Black Death has such a plague swept over the world, he says, adding that the need of a new survey of public health measures has never been more forcibly illustrated.
Oh my God. That's, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, so the 1918 flu is kind of famous for being forgotten. Wasn't widely taught in schools. You won't find it written about in a lot of novels and plays. But what I didn't realize is that it wasn't just forgotten after the fact. It was ignored in the moment as it was happening. And there are a lot of reasons for this. I mean, you had censorship in certain countries. You had self-censorship in this country. Journalists feeling like maybe they had to keep morale up and stay focused on the war. Not to mention there wasn't much anyone felt that they could do about the flu. It was even kind of familiar. Came around every year, and that year there was just more of it. But on top of that, and this is what I find interesting, they didn't even know what it was. Like, think about a couple months ago, March, coronavirus. Immediately you began to see these illustrations in the paper of the spiky ball. My kids started drawing pictures of the spiky ball. We all had something we could visualize. Back then, they had no picture of the enemy. They didn't even know the flu was a virus. It was truly invisible. And yet this tiny, unseen, unspoken of force was reshaping human history in all kinds of surprising ways. This show began with a simple question. What happens afterward, after this? Molly Webster, who you'll hear from later in the program, suggested, well, let's look back at what happened after that one. And that's what we're going to do today. As we enter the summer of coronavirus and look forward to the fall, we have five stories of how the invisible hand of that flu has continued to guide and shape us for the last 100 years and has left the world a very different place. Okay, so these dispatches are a full team affair. We're going to start things off, well, we started with Pat. We're going to keep it going with reporters Tad Davis and Matt Kielty.
Yeah, so Tad and I, we talked to
Ramon Arabini,
a couple of historians.
I don't hear. Can you hear him?
Yeah, I can hear him.
Okay.
John Barry.
Professor at Tulane University.
And
hello?
Margaret.
Oh, hi. Good.
Margaret McMillan.
Professor at University of Oxford.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So if we jump in near the end of 1918, there's a ceasefire. World War I is coming to an end. And I'm just wondering, like, what's the general mood?
Well, you know, there was this sort of mixed feeling that on the one hand, in the Allied countries, they'd won the war, and that at least was over. But it also left a tremendous amount of chaos. Large parts of Europe were in revolution. Empires were collapsing. And probably 9 million dead of the combatants, and goodness knows how many more who died of starvation or disease. So there was a lot of grief, a lot of concern about where the world was going. But also, I think there was a real longing for some sort of better world.
And that new better world was supposed to come in the form of a peace treaty.
So January 1919, all the Allied leaders come together in Paris.
And who all were the Allies in World War I?
The key ones were France, Great Britain, and then, of course, the United States.
And John told us that when the president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, arrived in Paris,
he entered almost as a conquering hero.
Huge crowds turned out to see him. Because for a lot of Europeans, and not just Europeans, a lot of people around the world, he represented a new hope.
Because for the past year, Wilson had been giving these speeches about what the war meant to the United States.
And in them, he called for things like peace without victory, that there were no losers in this war.
He called for the end of colonialism, imperialism. He called for the creation of this thing that had never existed before, that he was calling the League of Nations, where countries could just come together to talk through their differences rather than going to war over him.
It was all of this that had people calling Wilson the god of justice.
But worth mentioning that Wilson...
You were for him or against him.
...was a bit of an ass.
And that if you disagreed with him, he would cut you.
And more importantly, he was also extremely racist.
He's not my favorite president, you know, his person.
Which is a whole other story. But with a lot of historical accuracy and a little bit of drama,
Monsieur le Président,
to continue with this story,
Mesdames, Messieurs,
January 18th, 1919,
je déclare la conférence de paix de Paris officiellement ouverte.
In the office of the French Foreign Ministry,
37 nations, 200 delegates packed into this big conference room
with lots of gold and mirrors
to come up with this peace treaty that they would eventually send to the enemy, Germany.
And at the front of the room, at this long table, were our two main players.
Woodrow Wilson.
And right next to him,
this short, bald man with a big white mustache.
The Prime Minister of France, Georges Clemenceau.
He looks like Mr. Monopoly.
But Clemenceau was ferocious.
His nickname was the Tiger.
And unlike Wilson, he was someone who, quote, had no real interest in humanity as a whole. His sole concern was for France.
And this would be a bit of a problem because Clemenceau, when it came to the enemy, Germany,
I don't think there is any question.
He wanted him treated like an enemy.
That we are here to decide the issue of German guilt and ultimately German reparations.
Because as the French kept on saying, we didn't start the war. Germany declared war on us. And
the conduct of Germany is almost unexampled in human history.
The damage done to France was enormous.
The French had lost more men in the war than any other country.
Everyone in France had someone who died, knew someone who died.
There must be justice for the dead and wounded.
Whole villages had been wiped out, towns destroyed.
And for those who have been orphaned and bereaved.
He was saying someone should pay for this, and it should be Germany.
Because Germany saw fit to gratify her loss for tyranny by resort to war.
He essentially wanted to put the boot on Germany's neck.
He didn't want Germany just to pay. He wanted payback for what Germany did.
He wanted revenge.
Problem was,
Wilson didn't.
Wilson wanted to go easy on Germany. It was his whole peace without victory thing.
So Wilson and Clemenceau, they'd get together
virtually every day.
Privately.
Often in Woodrow Wilson's study.
There'd be a nice little spread.
Tea and coffee and chocolate eclairs and things.
And the two of them,
George,
would go at it.
How long must we repeat history?
Wilson preaching peace and unity.
Before we learn that revenge won't work.
And Clemenceau,
your history is a short one.
Being just like, look, the Germans
must pay.
Need to be brought to their knees.
The Germans are defeated.
And they would argue back and forth.
They must not be destroyed.
And back and forth.
The Germans have attacked us before. They'll do it again.
And they'd argue about the League of Nations.
We need to be just.
About German reparations.
Justice is what Germany shall have.
And these negotiations.
Justice for the peoples.
Started to drag.
Who now stagger under the war debts which exceed 30 billion pounds.
And drag.
They cannot.
No one seems to be.
Pay that much.
Budging.
And eventually things started to get diplomatically heated.
John told us that for one meeting, Wilson turned to an aide
and called the French, quote,
damnable.
In another meeting,
you, sir,
Clemenceau called Wilson,
are pro-German.
Pro-German and left the room.
At one point, the British Prime Minister, who was always in these talks,
he said, I feel as I'm sitting between Napoleon.
Mais pour qui me pense-t-il?
And
I am not thinking only of Germany.
Jesus Christ.
I am thinking about the future of the world.
Mais monsieur, vous rigolez?
And this went on January.
We must make peace.
February, March.
There is no peace.
And then eventually Wilson,
he gets angry.
So much so.
I want the steam engines prepared.
That he threatens to just leave to go back to the States.
On several occasions.
And Clemenceau said rather unkindly,
he's like a cook who keeps the trunk ready in the hallway.
Because Wilson could never actually bring himself to go.
In late March, Wilson told his wife, quote, well, thank God I can still fight and I'll win.
A few days later, he tells an aide,
we've got to make peace on the principles laid down and accept it or not make it at all.
That was April 2nd.
Then the next day after that, April 3rd.
Wilson gets sick.
To quote his doctor, Wilson was seized with violent fits of coughing, which were so severe and frequent that it interfered with his breathing, unquote.
He had a fever.
His fever hit 103.
His health starts deteriorating so fast that his doctor thought he was poisoned.
Because of intestinal symptoms.
Does that just mean like stomach pain?
Yeah, and vomiting, diarrhea.
Turns out all symptoms of
influenza.
By this point, April of 1919, millions of people had already died of the flu. There had been these three big waves. And John told us this kind of remarkable thing is that as the flu had been rampaging, Wilson had never spoken of it.
Not once.
Not publicly.
He was focused entirely on the war. That's all he cared about.
And here's Wilson in Paris trying to put an end to the Great War, trying in some ways, he thought, to put an end maybe to just like war forever while the third wave of the flu was moving through Paris. Now, whether Wilson contracted the flu,
I think we'll never know.
Margaret points out, like, we truly can't know.
It could have been. I think it was more than a cold. I mean, he really was very sick.
But for John, who wrote a whole book about the 1918 flu, he's like, a lot of the classic symptoms were there. Diarrhea, nausea, fever, coughing, shortness of breath. And also this one peculiar symptom.
Mental disorder.
John said for people who contracted the flu back then,
it's extremely common to be disoriented,
to feel restless,
to become delirious. And Wilson,
do you hear them?
Definitely showed those symptoms.
They're right outside the door.
One of Wilson's closest aides
said nothing we could say to disabuse his mind of the thought.
They hear me.
Sir, who are you talking about?
That the home was filled with French spies.
The French.
Also, around this time, Wilson,
take the chairs,
according to an aide,
acquired a peculiar notion.
Move them, move them.
That he was personally responsible.
Straight lines.
Over all the property and the furnished place he was occupying.
Put them in straight lines.
Something queer was happening in his mind.
The British Prime Minister referred to it as,
quote, nervous and spiritual breakdown.
Clemenceau, when he got wind,
he is worse today,
said to someone,
do you know his doctor? Can you get around him and bribe him?
At the same time, Wilson's doctor is saying, these are terrible days for the president.
Wilson would be sick and in bed for about a week. But even after he recovered, one of his aides said,
quote, one thing was certain, he was never the same after this little spell of sickness.
April 8th.
He goes back to the peace conference.
Back to negotiating with Clemenceau.
But he's a different man. He's weaker.
Even one of his Secret Service aides noticed.
Wilson lacked his old quickness of grasp and tired easily, unquote.
And this is the thing, is that John said, after Wilson got sick,
gave in on practically every point,
he seemed to just fold to Clemenceau.
He went in with this idea to go light on Germany and came out with almost the opposite.
The final treaty called for everything Clemenceau wanted, harsh reparations on Germany, a huge reduction in its military, a loss of a bunch of territory.
Germany was pretty much eviscerated.
As Germany's foreign minister put it, quote, they could have expressed the whole thing more simply in one clause. Germany renounces its existence, unquote.
Now, Wilson did end up getting his League of Nations, but Germany, in the end, wasn't allowed to join it, which was pretty much a slap in the face. But some people say because Wilson got this big thing that he wanted all along, that's why he was willing to give up on everything else.
But I don't think so. What he did in caving in was so foreign to everything in his personality and everything in his history. I can't prove it was a disease, but I don't see another reasonable explanation. And after Wilson made the concessions, a whole group of his top but younger aides met and considered whether they should resign in protest. One of them wrote Wilson a blistering letter of resignation.
It came from a diplomat named William C. Bullitt.
Quote, I am sorry that you did not fight our fight to the finish and that you had so little faith in the millions of men like myself in every nation who had faith in you. Our government has consented now to deliver the suffering peoples of the world to new oppressions, subjections, and dismemberments. A new century of war.
June 28th, 1919, the Germans would eventually sign what is known as the Treaty of Versailles. And what happens next is something that's debated by historians. There's some like Margaret who say,
there was a real problem here, and that was increasingly Germans felt they hadn't lost.
There was this growing sentiment amongst Germans that they could have won the war. It was just that, like, these liberal leaders surrendered too soon.
And so if you feel you haven't lost, no treaty is going to seem fair.
But there are many historians who say that this treaty, the Treaty of Versailles, which was so harsh on Germany, pretty much forced them into a depression, humiliated the German people by blaming them for the war, that this treaty would sort of create this foundation for the rise of the Nazis. And obviously everything that followed. The Holocaust, Pearl Harbor, D-Day, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the deaths of upwards of 80 million people. And it's kind of made me think a lot about Paris 1919, how there was this moment where you had these two important men, Wilson and Clemenceau, who would be sitting at some table in Wilson's study or that big long table in the conference room and argue about what the world should become after the end of this first great war. And I sort of keep imagining that, like, in those rooms where Wilson and Clemenceau are sitting, that there's this other chair there, this empty chair. You know, it's over by itself. No one's paying attention to it. And I just keep thinking how it was almost as if the virus itself kind of had a seat at the table.
Reporters Tad Davis and Matt Kilty. Okay, so a lot of the recorded history of the 1918 flu is rather Eurocentric. In this next dispatch, which comes from reporter Sarah Kari, we're going to tell a story about how the flu gave the arc of history and this one particular individual a little nudge all the way on the other side of the world.
So the place where it starts, kind of, is it's May of 1918. I think it's like May 29th, 1918. There's a ship that docks in the port city of Bombay, now known as Mumbai. It's carrying Indian troops home from World War I.
I didn't know India fought in World War I.
Yeah.
Indian soldiers prepare to embark for service overseas.
India was a British colony at the time, so about 1 million Indian soldiers were off fighting the war for the British.
Splendid soldiers, splendid fighters. They will give a good account of themselves wherever they may serve.
Some of them were in, like, France and Belgium. Also, others, like the ones getting off this ship, were coming from Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq.
Huh.
Anyway, so this ship, it's only there for about 48 hours. But in those 48 hours, in addition to those soldiers, the flu also disembarks. A few days later, this one police officer that had been stationed at the dock shows up at the hospital running a fever. Then six other police officers get sick. A few days later, it's a bunch of men working for a local shipping company. Then it's people working at the dockyard. The disease starts to spread through the city of Bombay, and from there, throughout India. Now, meanwhile, just north of Bombay, in the state of Gujarat, there's a man that's taking the train from city to city, giving speeches. He's a lawyer, activist, big proponent of nonviolent resistance, and his name is Mohandas Gandhi.
Ah.
This is him speaking much later, but just to help you imagine. And the thing is, like, in these speeches, he's actually recruiting people to fight in World War I for the British.
Really?
It's very surprising, right? I mean, Gandhi definitely had some blind spots. He even, like, made some racist comments about black people when he was in South Africa. And when it came to India, he had this idea that, like, if Indians fight for the British, then they will, in return, get more autonomy. To quote from some of these speeches that he gave,
India has altogether lost the capacity to fight. It has not a particle of the courage it should have. We are regarded as a cowardly people. If we want to become free from that reproach, we should learn the use of arms.
So for him, it was a show of strength, but also kind of like a bargaining chip.
I see. So he thought if Indians prove their strength, the British would reward them.
Yeah, something like that. So through that summer, the flu is spreading through India. Gandhi is running around giving speeches. And then all of a sudden, on August 17th, he writes a letter where he says, I'm on my back.
Is that what he literally said? I'm on my back?
Yeah.
That's like the letter equivalent of a text message. Like, sick, can't talk.
Exactly.
What else does he say?
He says, Dear Mr. Henderson, I'm on my back. I'm passing through the severest illness of my life, and I was incapable of sending you a letter earlier.
And he got the flu.
Well, it's kind of unclear. Like, one person I spoke to argued that it could have been the flu. Other people said it probably wasn't. We honestly can't know for sure. According to Gandhi's own account, he got food poisoning from something that he ate and came down with a case of dysentery. But the thing is, it was really bad. The appetite had all gone. I had all along thought that I had an iron frame, but I found that my body had now become a lump of clay. I have almost to crawl to reach the lavatory, and I have such griping pain that I feel like screaming.
I wanted to scream all the time, but controlled the urge with great effort. I longed to die and be free from it all.
Whoa.
It went on for about 5 months, like approximately from August of 1918 to somewhere around January of the next year, which lines up exactly with the time of that terrible second wave of the flu in India. And so at the exact time that Gandhi was on his back, so was India. Like, it was utter devastation. And the colonial government was basically doing nothing. The sanitary commissioner of the state of Punjab writes, the hospitals were choked so that it was impossible to remove the dead quickly enough to make room for the dying. The streets and lanes of cities were littered with dead and dying people.
Wow.
The postal and telegraph services were completely disorganized. The train service continued, but at all the principal stations, dead and dying were being removed from the trains. The burning cot, which is a cremation site, and burial ground were literally swamped with corpses, whilst an even greater number awaited removal. Nearly every household was lamenting a death, and everywhere terror and confusion reigned.
Whoa.
You know, in the US, we had about 500,000 people that died from the flu. In India, it was somewhere between 10 and 20 million people just in those few months.
Oh my God.
Which is more than the number of soldiers that died in World War I globally. Like, we talk about the forgotten flu, but the part that was most forgotten was what happened in India.
Wow, yeah. And Gandhi's on his back through that whole period?
Yeah. He finds out that his son and daughter-in-law have come down with the Spanish flu as well. His daughter-in-law actually ended up dying from it.
Wow.
I actually started reading through some of his letters from this time, and they're fascinating because you see him go from, like, writing these long screeds about politics and war recruiting to, like, real soul-searching. For instance, around October or so, about 2 months into his illness, he's so sick that he starts to think that he might die.
Dear Harilal, I have a feeling that I'm now going. I have very little time left. The body is becoming weaker and weaker.
You start to see him kind of contemplating his own life.
But the inheritance of character which I'm leaving to you is invaluable in my view. I wish you to cherish it. Follow the path of religion. The more I contemplate this illness, the more deeply I realize what love of man to man must be, and therefore love of God.
He's like reflecting on God and
nature is God and God is love.
And nature, and Gandhi had this philosophy about illness where
mysterious is the way karma works itself out.
Any illness that you experience, often it's something that you've brought on to yourself.
We reap as we sow. We get what we deserve. In this illness, I can see my own fault at every step.
Because he thought that way about illness, when he actually got sick, he started to reflect, what have I done to bring this on? And if you read his letters, it seems like part of that was realizing that recruiting for the war effort was misguided.
One need not assume that heroism is to be acquired only by fighting in a war. One can do so even while keeping out of it. War is one powerful means among many others, but if it is a powerful means, it is also an evil one.
That the way to have strength is not to fight for the British in a war, of all things.
We can cultivate manliness in a blameless way.
It was to fight against them through nonviolent means. What ends up happening is he emerges from his illness.
As he moves across the dusty roads of India, this frail little man marshals his people.
And begins speaking to crowds again. The war is over, he's done recruiting, and he says now that
it is not wrong to defy laws that are unfair.
We have to resist. By this time, the British have passed a law allowing them to arrest people without really any reason. And the people of India, meanwhile, have been through all of this death and suffering and seen that the colonial government was powerless to help them or just didn't care to. So this time, the crowds are much bigger. They're ready for Gandhi's message.
The temper of the people rose, and so did the temper of the alien government.
To which the British respond by
flares into open violence,
cracking down even further,
prompt action by the authorities,
massacring hundreds of people in a city called Amritsar. And in the wake of that, Gandhi writes,
"It seems I shall have to fight the greatest battle of my life."
Wow.
From a handful of demonstrators, the marchers become a crowd, and then an army, unstoppable. Gandhi's name becomes their battle cry.
It's a long time before Indians actually get their independence. I think 28 years to be exact. But this moment, when the Spanish flu sweeps India and both India and Gandhi emerge from this time of extreme hardship, I think you can say that this is the moment. Where independence really starts to take shape.
Coming up, dangerous bodies, ether ghosts, pig reservoirs, and whale flu. It's right after the break. Science reporting on Radiolab is supported in part by Science Sandbox, a Simons Foundation initiative dedicated to engaging everyone with the process of science.
So far, the president has raised over $60 million for his future library, a lot of it coming from settlements with news organizations.
The president is probably laughing at the fact that he's getting these media organizations, which he considers to be enemies, to be helping him create a shrine to the Trump years.
The mixed history and threatened future of presidential libraries on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
I'm Jad Abumrad. This is Radiolab. The idea for this set of dispatches is simple. As we head into the summer of Corona and into the uncertainty of the next few months, we thought it was a good time to sort of look forward by looking back to the aftermath of the 1918 flu and to chart the many ways that the silent, invisible hand of that flu virus has shaped human history. This next one comes from producer Latif Nasser. All right, I'm ready.
Okay.
Take me on a journey, Latif, back in time.
And you're going back in time and you're going across the globe.
Nice.
To Vienna.
Okay.
In the early 1900s.
Okay.
I mean, it's the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it's like one of the cultural capitals of the world. It has this, you know, great classical legacy, you know, like Mozart and Beethoven and Hofburg Palace and that kind of thing. But at this moment in the early 1900s, it's just like bursting into modernity. Mm. There was one point in 1913 where within about 2 miles in central Vienna, you could find Stalin, Trotsky, Freud, and Hitler. like they would have been going to the same coffee shop.
Isn't that
crazy?
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So anyway, so Vienna was this place in time where it's like, wow, this has a sort of disproportionate mark on the 20th century, right? And I want to tell you about a guy who was at that place at that time named Egon Schiele.
Egon Schiele, okay.
So 1907, at the time he was a teenager, he wanted to be an artist, studied at the Vienna Academy of Fine Arts, but he found his teacher so stifling that he drops out. And he decides to seek out his idol, one of the best-known artists in all of Vienna, Gustav Klimt.
Oh, he had a famous painting that there was like a woman that people put up on their dorm rooms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like she's like in gold leaf. It's called The Kiss.
Yes, that one. Yeah.
That's Klimt. So you have this like teenage art school dropout approaching his artistic hero who's 30 years his senior. And supposedly, kind of the way the story goes, Schiele shows him some of his sketches. He asks him whether he has any talent. And Klimt says, much too much.
Mm.
It's this sort of monumental moment. And within a few years, Schiele skyrockets to success. And in exhibitions, like you'll find their work alongside each other.
Wow, no kidding.
Now, just to give you a sense of what this guy Schiele, what his work is like this guy's not a bowl of fruit guy. He loves drawing portraits, and including and especially nudes. Like he draws men, women, male couples, female couples, himself masturbating, women masturbating. A lot of people at the time considered him a pornographer. He even gets arrested and thrown in jail at one point, and then they just let him out of jail a few weeks later. And you can see why people found some of his work unsettling. Like, he would be drawing his sister, like, very detailed nudes of his sister, detailed nudes of, like, underage girls, you know, sickly people. There's a drawing he does, like, of the scrotum of a newborn baby boy.
Wow.
Like, it's weird. It's really weird. And one of the Schiele experts I talked to, Verena Gomper, she was like, to Schiele, painting bodies was a way of investigating the deepest questions about life. And just looking at them myself, like, you can see, like, he just wanted to see people.
Yeah.
And the way people actually were, not the way they were supposed to look, like, just the way they really actually looked.
Mm.
So a few years later, 1915, he marries Edith Harms.
Okay.
3 days after the wedding, he has to report for active duty in the Austrian military. A couple years later, he gets reassigned back to Vienna. And soon after, he finds out that his mentor, Gustav Klimt, is in the hospital.
Hmm.
Klimt had a stroke. And while he's in the hospital recuperating, he contracts pneumonia. So Schiele goes to see his mentor on his deathbed. But he's too late. So instead, he goes to the morgue and sits next to Klimt's body and starts to sketch him. Like almost like a death mask, you know, like it's like he's making a death mask or something like that.
Like trying to freeze him or something or hold him or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Klimt dies and sort of as Schiele is reeling from the death of his mentor, he's actually professionally doing better than ever. The whole Vienna art scene sees him as this rock star. He buys a new, like, big studio, and he talks about how he was going to convert his old studio into this kind of new, revolutionary kind of, like, art school. It wasn't just going to be a kind of a traditional art school the way that he had gone to. He hoped that there would be these kind of cohorts of artists behind him that he could help train the way he wished he had been trained. And besides that, his wife, Edith, she becomes pregnant. But then comes the fall, when the big second wave of the flu pandemic hits.
Hmm.
And according to the Schiele biographer, Jane Collier, there's this family story that Edith, who is by this point 6 months pregnant, she decides to go out and get some groceries. She goes downtown and comes back with the flu.
Oh, wow.
So Sheila just attends to her over the next couple of days and just has to watch as she's, you know, struggling to breathe, and as she and also obviously their unborn child just kind of start to fade away.
Whoa.
And the night before she dies, she asks for a pen and paper and writes this kind of barely legible note with super loopy handwriting, which says something like, "I love you and I love you endlessly, Edith."
Wow.
And Sheila, he's sort of sitting next to her, and just like he did with Klimt, he just sketches her. So he makes this really gut-wrenchingly sad portrait of Edith.
You see her in the bed.
Sheila biographer Jane Collier.
Her head is propped up on pillows. Her eyes are half closing but trying to stay open. You see her fading away.
So
she died that night?
So she lived through the night, she died in the morning. And then it's that same day that Sheila first starts to shiver.
Oh, wow.
So for the next 3 days, he lays in bed with a high fever, and he dies the same day as her funeral.
Whoa.
Yeah, he was 28, she was 25.
Wow, so that's horrible. Like, this guy whose life is about to just explode suddenly has these three deaths in rapid succession. Wow, what do you make of that?
One of the ideas that the biographer, Jane Collier, brought up was this term that Gertrude Stein coined called the lost generation.
And when we hear that phrase, usually you think of F. Scott Fitzgerald or Hemingway, the
nihilism of young people who lived through the 19-teens. But there's another way to read it.
The lost generation were people who were literally lost. They weren't there anymore. They were gone.
And in a way, Sheila is one of the kind of the crystallizations of that. Like, he's one of the clearest examples of that. Someone who was brilliant, someone who's prolific. Like, he had this sort of spark that was snuffed out. Mm. So that made me wonder, like, what would it have been like if they had survived? Like, how would modern art, how would the modern world be different? It's funny, I asked these two different scholars, and they had kind of the same answer, which was sort of striking. They were like, Sheila was into drawing people, right? He was into drawing bodies. He was into drawing these human figures. But after the war, modern art in Europe moves away from figural work, like human figures, and then towards abstraction. Whoa. And it was only relatively recently that Sheila's work became in vogue again.
Wow. That's kind of, that gives me chills just thinking about that. It's like, for somebody who so passionately took in the human form, to then in the wake of the pandemic and the war, it's just too painful to take in the human forms anymore. And so we have to look away, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I hear in that story.
Yeah, and it does feel like between the war and the pandemic, like, that whole generation must have seen the human body in such, like, in its most, like, seen it in the frailest way, in the most visceral way. Like, it's like, oh, I don't want to see that anymore.
Well, don't you have, I remember you saying something like this. I mean, bodies look dangerous now.
Mm.
I saw this picture. It was one of those, like, it was a Condé Nast publication that I guess had been done right before the pandemic. And it had on the cover these two millennials embracing and kissing each other. And I remember seeing this photo and just recoiling the idea of two human bodies touching. I was like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Get away from each other. Like, there's some way in which the human body, like this it's radioactive now.
It's weird because there's a way in which, I don't know, it's like at this moment our bodies are simultaneously, they seem so dangerous and like weapons, but then also like our bodies seem so vulnerable, like the idea that like someone's, you know, knee on a neck like could be, yeah, could be that devastating, you know, like it just, it, like you feel it, I don't know. It's like it's like at this moment, there's these two conflicting things. Like it's like bodies is so vulnerable and bodies is so dangerous. Mm.
Producer Latif Nasser. Next up, Rachel Cusick.
Okay. I am at your service.
All right.
Ready to be inspired and amazed?
Well, I don't know how much I'm going to inspire you, because I think you know a lot of what I'm about to say because you are a radio man. But I appreciate you faking enthusiasm for the next 30 minutes. I'm really...
No, I'm not going to fake it. It's sort of like... Oh, my God. My child just scared out of me.
So good.
But anyhow, okay, so where would you like to launch in?
Let's start in the fall of 1919. The war is over, the flu is winding down, and we're in Pittsburgh with this guy,
Frank Conrad, who had been a ham operator before the war, and once the war ends, in his garage, he sets up his or resets up his amateur station.
So that's Susan Douglas, radio historian.
And I am a professor of communication and media at the University of Michigan.
And back then, radio broadcasts were really just Morse code, just a bunch of beeps and boops. But Frank was about to change that.
He worked for Westinghouse, which was an electrical manufacturing company. So he thus had access to vacuum tubes that were used for transmission.
And all you need to know about vacuum tubes is that they were the secret bit of technology that let radio go from this to this thing that's full of life. But also, in that moment in history, in the wake of the flu, weirdly made us confront death.
Absolutely.
So on October 17th, 1919, Frank is in his garage with these fancy vacuum tubes. And then he picks up a microphone.
Pushed up to a phonograph.
And music floated out of Frank's little garage into the air. There's no recording of this broadcast. All we know is that Frank talked a little, played some music, and about 35 miles away, all the way across Pittsburgh, those sounds reached the ears of a little boy named Harry Mills.
I remember it was 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and all at once this voice appears. And I remember letting out a yelp or a shout of some sort, and my dad, who had just gotten out of the bath, come in wrapped in a towel to be sure I was all right. Something hadn't happened to me. And I said, "Dad, look, I'm hearing this fella talking." And we shared the headphones. We only had one pair of headphones. And he allowed us, I was right.
What a moment that must have been.
Can you, right?
To like, suddenly, like...
Imagine that that's never happened before. You didn't realize that the radio could even do that.
Yeah.
And then his voice, like, fills your bedroom. I think that's just the coolest thing ever.
It's super cool.
And other people thought it was pretty cool, too.
One of the Pittsburgh newspapers began reporting on this.
And once word literally got out,
that there was this guy broadcasting a voice and music from his garage in Pittsburgh.
Soon, all of these places...
America needs a tidal wave of the old-time religion.
Religious organizations.
Union makes us strong.
Labor unions.
Wanted to do what Frank did in his garage.
In the Rose Bowl, Michigan lives up to advantage.
Colleges and universities.
newspapers, the Boy Scouts.
Everybody wanted in on this.
And at this moment, the radio you'd have in your home is really just a bunch of coils and wires.
And a crystal. There was this little wire, and it was called a cat whisker.
Wow.
And you would basically move it around the crystal until you got something.
And in came the world.
People have been asking me for the last 2 days, why put a ventriloquist on the air? The answer is, why not?
And
we'd appreciate it if anyone hearing this broadcast would communicate with us.
As you'd move the whisker around that crystal,
you were not just hearing voice and music. You were hearing howls. You were hearing screeches. You were hearing static. All of this kind of atmospheric noise that was...
Go ahead, please.
Really creepy and really weird, you know?
You heard all of these sounds that lived between the voices, between the everyday human world and something that stretched beyond it.
And let's remember the context. By the end of World War I, between 10 and 20 million people had been killed.
And then another 50 million or so were killed by the flu. Pretty much everybody knew somebody who had died, a friend or a family member or a loved one, and they were
desperate for some kind of way of coping.
And so when people heard these mysterious voices on the radio,
hello, hello there,
a lot of them wondered,
is somebody trying to reach me? Are they okay on the other side? Is there another side? Can I communicate with the undead?
Susan says this was a real moment where spiritualism took off.
Ouija boards were flying off the shelves. People did go to seances.
People thought maybe my brother or mother or cousin or whoever else I lost was out there floating around in this space called the ether, which is also where people believed the radio waves lived.
And so explorations of the ether, via radio, might be the way in which we could connect with the dead.
It's so interesting. Like, I don't think I ever would have come across these stories in any other moment in time, like in my own heart and head, and felt like any sort of sympathy for the people who wanted to believe in the spiritualists, like who would go to seances and buy Ouija boards. But like the moment we're living in right now, where I'm speaking to you from my closet and I haven't seen anyone besides my roommate in weeks. And like the other day I was like, because I'm in an apartment with one other person and I had just been talking to my roommate for so long. And I was like, all right, I got to get out of this, but there's no excuse to get out of here. And then I was just like, oh, yeah, I got a phone call with my siblings. I got to go. And then I walked into my room and just to like play it off, like I actually had a phone call.
Yeah.
I just like began speaking as if I was speaking to my siblings and like responding to these imaginary things that they would say. Like I imagined my sister would be talking about her baby and then my other sister would be talking about this dinner she made and I would respond and imagine. And I must have sounded crazy and I do sound crazy, but it felt so good to like do that. It was like playing house or like make believe. But it felt so real, and I don't think I ever would have done it before this moment. But I just have this sense of empathy for those people, and I'm just as crazy as they are, I guess.
Yeah.
Producer Rachel Cusick. Okay, rounding things out, Molly Webster.
So far, we've done a lot of stories about human history and human experience, but my 1918 thing was... what happened to the virus?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, at the time, we couldn't see it. We didn't have the technology to see it. We didn't even know it was a virus. We didn't know that much about viruses. And so it really was an unseen force. But that all changed in 1997, thanks in a big way to a guy named Johan Holten.
Johan Holten.
Yeah, he is like a legend as a science adventurer. And so basically the story goes is like Johan got very interested in trying to see if they could get a sample of the 1918 flu and learn about it. So he went to Brevik Mission, Alaska, which is a very, very cold place where bodies would be preserved. And there was a known flu outbreak there late in the pandemic that killed most of the village. And so he dug down into the permafrost where there was essentially this mass grave, went into bodies, took out portions of the lungs, then sent those samples to a lab in Washington, D.C., run by this guy.
Hello, it's Jeff Taubenberger.
Hey, Jeff, it's Molly Webster. Hi. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Dr. Jeffrey Taubenberger.
I'm a senior investigator at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland.
Anyways, back in 1997, Jeff took those samples into the lab, and he was able to kind of really see the virus itself.
So if you sequence all the genes of the 1918 bars, which
as you did.
We did in my lab back in the 1990s.
And what he saw, so to speak, was all of this genetic material called RNA.
Influenza is an RNA virus, but the RNA that makes up the genome of the influenza virus is not just on one string, one continuous strand of RNA.
Huh.
It's on 8 separate little pieces called segments.
Really?
You can think of
According to Jeff, you can think of those segments as genes. So there are 8 different genes all doing different things.
And once you have that exact sequence, now you can do very careful genealogy.
By comparing those genes to other genes and other flus from 1918 all the way up to today.
You can just follow it and you can look at how things change over time.
You can put together a very thorough life history of this virus.
Yeah, it's a crazy story.
The first thing to know is that when the pandemic petered out, like around 1920 or so, the virus itself did not.
No, the pandemic virus never went away. It just started circulating annually, causing influenza.
And as more and more people became immune to it, it basically became like the normal flu.
Spread person to person.
Through 1921 and 22.
Changing a little bit every single year.
Enough so it wouldn't die out because of immunity, but we're still talking about the same baseline flu that infected and killed everyone in 1918, running around, dominant virus, traveling all over the world.
Throughout the 20s and beyond.
Through the 1920s, the 1930s, 1940s, goes into the 1950s, and then we get to 1957.
Somehow in 1957, a dual infection occurred between the human virus that derived from 1918 and an unknown bird virus.
Wait, there's a meeting of two viruses right at the doorstep to a cell?
Yeah.
Yes.
And because they were both flu viruses, they both had those 8 gene segments, which means they could
mix and match those genes and create a new virus.
It's like a plug and play or something.
Yeah, think of Lego blocks. You know, you can put them together in different ways as long as you have a complete set.
So these two viruses end up swapping their genes, and the 1918 virus ends up with 3 new genes. Now, 2 of those genes make very important proteins.
The 2 major proteins that are sticking out on the surface of the virus, like the little spikes that stick out from membrane around the virus.
Those 2 proteins are abbreviated H and N. So the 1918 virus was H1N1. And when it bumped into this other virus, it got a new H and a new N.
When that happened, what you had was a new virus that had all the core machinery that had already been adapted to humans of the 1918 virus, but it now had proteins on the surface that nobody had immunity to, and so it could cause a new pandemic.
After almost 40 years of, you know, being the regular old flu and making people sick, but like not that sick, in 1957, all of a sudden there was a new version of this virus.
H2N2 virus.
And thanks to that new H and N, it killed over 1 million people worldwide and over 100,000 in the U.S.
And it, so
it's like a serial killer that went and changed its clothes or something.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, the core of the virus was still derived from 1918. And then the crazy thing is that just 11 years later, 1968, that 1957 virus interacted in some way, somehow, with another bird virus.
Did the gene swapping thing again, got itself a new H?
And that became H3.
What?
But the N2 from 1957 stayed the same.
With the backbone of, yes, go ahead, sorry. Oh.
It's five genes from the 1918 virus, two genes from the 1968 virus, and one gene from the 1957 virus. And then in 1977, the H1N1 virus, all eight genes from the 1918 virus that stopped circulating in 1957, came back into human circulation.
No.
20 years later. Yes.
Wow.
And that H1N1 virus co-circulated with the H3N2 virus, so that we had two different strains competing with each other for annual flu season. And then that circulated until they were replaced by a new pandemic that had a really complicated and mixed up origin and relation to 1918.
Okay, so to understand this next part, you have to know that most flus come from birds and they go into us, but they can go into other animals too.
Horses or dogs, whales and seals and camels and bats that have flu. That
whales?
They probably all have a... Yes, whales. Influenza viruses are incredible.
The reason that that matters is it turns out that way back at the beginning of our story,
the 1918 virus most likely went from humans to pigs in 1918.
Whoa.
And then the virus adapted to pigs and made a pig-specific lineage of the 1918 virus that became swine influenza.
Oh, my God.
And so the human strain of 1918 goes off. And it goes through the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and onwards and onwards. Well, the pig strain is doing the same thing. It's going through the piggy 1920s and then the piggy 1930s and the piggy 1940s. And it's doing little changes along the way. And at some point, they give it back to us.
In a complex set of swapping genes between human viruses, pig viruses, and bird viruses, a new virus was created that has some of the genes from the 1918 virus, but some are derived from its human descendants. Two of them are derived from its swine flu descendants, and then a couple other genes from a bird virus. And that led to a new H1N1 virus in 2009.
This is so wild.
I know. But pig detour aside, I think the thing that was crazy about what Jeff told me is that that virus, the one that had the backbone of 1918, the one in 1968.
The 1968 H3N2 virus became the dominant form of influenza and is still the dominant form of influenza today.
Really?
More than 50 years later.
Does that mean that, like, the flu I might have gotten this past winter is built on the backbone of the 1918 strain?
It absolutely is. And, you know, here's the thing I think that's important to think about. If our data are correct, that a single transmission event from a bird virus to humans, say just before 1918, that led to the emergence of this new pandemic virus. Not only the tens of millions of people who died in the pandemic itself, estimated at least between 50 and maybe even 100 million people, but that the tens of millions of people who have died of influenza in the last 102 years are all directly related to a single event in which a bird virus adapted to humans.
Sometime before 1918, and no one really knows when, like a human, you know, touched some bird poop and scratched their nose or ate an infected chicken or like hugged a turkey or something. And this virus went from that bird, snuck into that human. And from there, it went from human to human to human to human to human to human to human every day of every year for the last 102 years.
So the 1918 virus is ultimately responsible for all the flu deaths that have occurred in 100 years, which is stunning to think about.
Wow, so the pandemic never finished. in a way.
Right.
It does also make you wonder. I mean, like, here we are with the coronavirus 6 months in. Like, are we at the start of some crazy 102-year journey with this virus?
Hello. Hi.
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 Hello.
So we actually called up the best person we could think of to answer that question. Okay, Dr. Fauci, such an honor to talk to you.
Sure.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, who probably at this point doesn't need an introduction, but when we got him on the line, we told him what we had learned about the 1918 virus, formed several times into smaller pandemics,
right,
stretching all the way into the 70s. And then we just asked him, do you see that sort of legacy stretching forward for COVID-19? Like in 100 years, are we going to look back on it the way we look back on 1918 now?
It is conceivable, but unpredictable and not inevitable. So COVID-19 is a brand new virus. It doesn't have the reassortment capabilities that the flu has. It doesn't have gene segments that would allow for what we call easy reassortment.
First thing he told us is that the coronavirus doesn't have those 8 segments that the flu viruses have, so it can't do that same swapping of parts.
All those genetic shenanigans, as it were.
But on the other hand, the coronavirus,
it certainly has the capability of mutate, so it could change.
Gotcha.
So I guess the question people are asking, is it conceivable that with this particular coronavirus that we're going to see versions of this as the years go by? You can never predict with certainty, but what I think we'll see over years is that we will either control it very well with a vaccine, which I do hope is the most likely option, or it will go through a couple of cycles of seasons, and then will take its place at a low-level threat, something that's present, that can be dealt with, that it doesn't, you know, impact us in a way that it's impacted now.
Gotcha. I guess that's comforting to hear. I mean, the best-case scenario being that we see a couple of cycles of this, and then a vaccine kind of tempers it and gently guides it into something of a low-level,
right,
something of a seasonal variety. What's the worst case scenario that keeps you up at night?
Well, I have to tell you, the worst case scenario that keeps me up at night, I'm living through right now. A brand new virus that jumps species, infects humans, and has the combined capability of spreading extremely rapidly from human to human, at the same time as it has a relatively high degree of morbidity and mortality. And that's exactly what we're in right now. Literally the perfect storm of a pandemic, which is the reason why, unlike other pandemics of different years, with the exception of 1918, which has some significant similarities, we have an epidemic that has essentially gripped the planet. So yes, this is indeed an unprecedented situation. We've not been here before, certainly no one in our generations.
You know, this whole show, I feel like, you know, it started because of a conversation you and I were having about, you know, what would it be like to emerge from this COVID-19 mm-hmm. era? So, okay, let's look back. Let's look back mm-hmm. at 1918 and see what happened in the years after that. And in doing that, we found all of these tendrils, artistic, technological, social, things that reached out not just past 1918, but all the way to now. And it just makes me feel like the way in which we think about the rulers of our histories are just not the rulers. It's like somehow we are not the masters of our destiny in the way that we think.
It is interesting because it's like the things that catch our eye are not always the things that define us.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it. Yeah.
It was in 1919. Yes, men and women was dying. With that stuff, which the doctors call the flu. People die everywhere. Death went creeping through the air. And the
was sad. It was in 19.
Okay, very special thanks for these dispatches to Verena Gomper, Rajmohan Gandhi, Siddharth Chandra, David Arnold, Laura Spinney, Simon Jutras, who played the role of Georges Clemenceau, our own David Gable, who played the role of Woodrow Wilson, Dan Fink for casting, and also the National Film Board of Canada for use of the film based on the book by Margaret Macmillan, Paris, 1919. Okay. I'm Jad Abumrad. Thank you for listening. Please stay safe, everybody.
This is Tim Scammell from New Maryland and New Brunswick, Canada. Radiolab is created by Jad Abumrad with Robert Krulwich and produced by Soren Wheeler. Dylan Keefe is our director of sound design. Susie Lechenberg is our executive producer. Our staff includes Simon Adler, Becca Bressler, Rachel Cusick, David Gebel, Bethel Habte, Tracy Hunt, Matt Keelty, Annie McEwen, Latif Nasser, Sarah Kari, Ariane Wack, Pat Walters, and Molly Webster. With help from Shima Oliai, W. Harry Fortuna, Sarah Sandbach, Melissa O'Donnell, Tad Davis, and Russell Gregg. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris.